Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today, I have a wonderful recurring guest, Daniel from Song Cai. It used to be called Song Cai Gin for many years. That's how, you know, we talked to each other. It's like you're from Song Cai Gin, but we are here for Song Cai Whiskey. This is a new product that, but this is not a product driven podcast. This is really about getting to know more, really about you and why you decided to go down the whiskey route, which I'm a huge fan and I couldn't wait for this to happen. So here we are. Welcome to the podcast, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks, Kenneth. It's great to be back on the podcast. And it's awesome because I feel like every time we meet, there's like evolution in both our lives. And I think that makes this podcast dynamic. You know, you can follow people through trajectories.
Yeah, indeed. We talk about you working in Vietnam and, you know, ultimately retiring to, back to somewhere. And I am here for it. I'm here for the next 60 years if we're, God willing, we can extend our lives and be old guys with long beards and talking about our evolution.
Yeah, we have to definitely aspire to that. We have to go into like the old Lao phases, you know what I mean? We have to really grow into that.
You know, there's a lot about you. Throughout the years we talk most about your work, but there's also like the jiu-jitsu and, you know, this all of this stuff that the academic side, the history side of Vietnam, and, you know, you living in Vietnam, speaking with a Hanoian accent while, you know, meeting your mom and dad, you know, at these events, and they're completely speaking with the Southern accent. And it's the most interesting thing. There's so many things about you that, that we could spend hours and years talking about. But here we are, we're at the, intersection of, you and whiskey.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of a culmination of a weird, like, migratory cycle in a way, you know, like where I don't know. I think sometimes I think about kind of my life's trajectory, and it's like a strange cycle, you know. Like I think you know, Vietnamese we talk about in so many different ways, but it's almost like Duyên Phận is definitely how it feels to me sometimes, like. It's weird because like my family's history, as many other families' histories, is tied to migration, you know, and it seems to me that there's like almost like a full circle in this migration and coming back to like rice, you know, like single grain. Our single grain project is all centered around rice. And I think that's like kind of been something that's been central in a lot of my family's, or what I feel like is my family's migration, you know, like I ended up in New Orleans, also a lot of rice based culture around there, and then back to Vietnam and to the north, and then exploring how Vietnam's rice culture is rapidly changing. But anyways, yeah, that's kind of like, sometimes I think about that a lot, is like the full circle of migration of, especially, you know, you and me, we're part of this diaspora where we are very hungry and curious about the land in which our parents fled, which is, it's poetic in its own way, you know?
You used the word fled right now, and that's probably not a kosher word in Vietnam to use, is it? I know how exact you are with your articulation and, but that's not the kind of word that you would use in Vietnam and Vietnamese in the north, is it?
Well, I think like yes and no. Like I think it depends on who you're talking to, and it depends on kind of how you want to frame history. I think there's a lot of, you know, what's funny is like you and I have been going to Vietnam and have a very long relationship with Vietnam, and I think it's been long enough where we can see how the language has shifted around the diaspora experience, you know. There's no beating around the bush. It was Viet Bien, you know, and there was a sense of flight, you know. I mean, like to revise it in any other way is just historical revisionism, you know. I think it's, I'm not afraid of saying that, because I'm also not afraid of saying also to my parents' generation is, I also think, you know, it goes both ways. I'm returning to Vietnam not because of some political agenda or trying to disregard their struggle or disregard their story, which I think is still very important. But I also think that we're so fortunate to be part of this nation building and cultural uplift in Vietnam that I think is astounding. I think that's kind of how I view it. I think the more clear and just upfront and honest we can be about history, the more we can together proceed with the future, you know, and in the present, be in the present with each other.
I love that answer. It cuts both ways. But I think the reason I bring that up is because I feel like the government doesn't use that kind of language or doesn't allow that kind of thinking to kind of like, I almost think it's a cultural thing that Asians, we as very Zuke, right? We're just very careful about how we kind of frame things around each other. We don't want each other to feel uncomfortable. And, you know, just when you say fled for me, I'm like, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I go to a lot of these government functions and especially by, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I think when you're talking, when different government agencies or departments are talking about the diaspora, the language changes and it's for specific reasons. I think the main underlying theme that seems to be constant throughout is a couple things. They want to ensure that there is no division within the community. So as long as your language or the ethos or kind of like what you're trying to portray is not what they call like chia zia san tok, you know, like trying to split apart the community, it's okay. Because overall, the overarching Vietnamese government stance, especially on the Vietnamese diaspora, especially since 2001, 2001 was when they had that decree saying that, you know, we are part of Vietnam and we are a part of Vietnam that cannot be removed. You know, they call us now Dong Bao. You know, Dong Bao was a strategic word that was signed into a decree in 2001. And that was the start of the Ủy ban Nhà nước về Việt Nam nước ngoài, which is like the part of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs specifically delegated to diasporic affairs. So I think overall, the Vietnamese government is very strategic in the way of they are trying to mend wounds. Of course, you know, maybe if you engage in like online banter, you know, you might catch some flack from like online netizens, you know, like the Red Bulls, which is like Vietnam's version of like MAGA. But the official government stance is that we are Dong Bao. We are Kieu Bao. We are part of the Vietnamese, like, enclave, the Vietnamese community. And they go so far to quote Ho Chi Minh in saying that Kieu Bao is, you know, một bộ phận mà không tách rời khỏi Vietnam được. We are part of Vietnam that cannot be removed and can't be separated from Vietnam, even though we are not living, Kieu Bao, overseas Vietnamese, are not maybe living physically in Vietnam. We are part of Vietnam wherever we go. So that's kind of like my encounter with it. Of course, you know, if you're doing some paperwork throughout Vietnam, sometimes they'll change up the word of like, oh, you're not fully Vietnamese. You're like, you know, American with Vietnamese roots. But that's technicalities. But the overall like feeling of it is they want to make us feel that we are part of Vietnam. And that's their way of reconciling history and moving forward.
The word Dong is the same.
Yeah.
Equal.
Yeah.
Homo.
Yeah,
the time, you know, same people. And I think Bao means people. What does like Bao mean?
Dong Bao. Yeah,
and it's country people. So countrymen, and I think these distinctions are so important. As I think about the work that you do, it's not just. I mean, alcohol is just one, like 5% of when I think about you. Yes. And to break down the etymology of how we're viewed in Vietnam is so critical. I started a podcast called Bao La with Little Saigon TV. And we speak a lot about these topics in Vietnamese. And it gets so sticky sometimes, you know? And the beauty is we have somebody who's very, very pro-American. You know, he came in 1985. Hwang Chung Tui, and then Jin Ok Lan came in 2005. I came in 1975. We all have this like 20-year increment, and you know, these things are in my mind. And then when I look at your label for single grain whiskey, my brain goes to being an American and this idea of whiskey in America. And the idea of whiskey in Vietnam is really the intersection of like, this is really cool. It's a really great time. And you didn't start out with this. You started out with the gin, and now we're here. And I wanted to talk about what inspired you to pick out this very, it's whiskey is a very Scottish. Would you say its origins is more Scotch?
I would say Scotch is a type of whiskey, and it's probably the most famous, and it could be considered some of the oldest types of whiskey, but it depends on how you define whiskey, you know? If we were to talk about civilizations that have distilled cereal grains, the East, meaning Asia, has actually distilled grains for hundreds, if not thousands of years earlier than Westerners. And so it depends on what you define as whiskey. Whiskey in certain parts of the world is just cereal grains that have been fermented and then distilled. You know, they're like to be called whiskey or like say Scotch, for example, Scotch has to be made in Scotland. Bourbon has to be made in America, and there has to be some sort of a wood component to it in modern day whiskey. But the core of it is just cereal grain that's been fermented and distilled. It was matured in whatever civilizations had laying around at the time. And in Scotland was oak barrels, same with America. But in Asia, we've been using amphora vessels for our traditional aging method.
What is that amphora vessel?
So is amphora that wood is just, or? It's clay. So it's basically chumsang. It's terracotta clay. And that's generally regarded as like the earliest, I would say, examples or records of fermented grains was found in amphora pots in China. I guess what I'm trying to say is whiskey, yes, is associated with Scotland. It's associated now in the newer world with like America, but then also the Asian whiskey culture is now rising with Japan, you know, Taiwan, and now the rest of Asia as well. But I think that for me, when I look at whiskey, it's actually really a reflection of different civilizations and how we approach the singular question of how do you ferment and distill grain and age it to create something tasty. And to me, that should reflect the ethos of how different regions make whiskey. And that's kind of how Scotch is different from bourbon. And even within Scotland, right? You were saying before you like Lafroy, like the Petey Islay whiskeys. That's also a reflection of that very particular region of Scotland. But if you cross the pond to America, we're doing bourbon, for example. That's also considered a whiskey. And if you cross the Pacific, now with Japan, where they're really coming into their own identity, they've got their own style of whiskey, which is Koji whiskey, you know? So they're going back and saying, we're actually going to lean hard into our Japanese identity and what distinguishes spirits from the rest of the world. And so when we started, some guy actually, it didn't fully mature that vision yet, but we started some guy distillery actually on the back of a lot of the work that I was doing before, which was around native grain research. A lot of my work was around native rice, corn, and other native botanicals in Vietnam. But rice was one of the key things. Because, you know, when people think about Vietnam and we think about the agriculture in Vietnam, we think of rice. Rice, there's so many legends of rice, right? And rice is something you can almost see from north to south. There are some examples of communities and regions that don't eat rice as a staple grain. They eat like Man Man, for example. But for the large part, a vast majority of Vietnamese, rice is our staple grain, you know? And why don't we have a whiskey that embodies that. We should be leaning into that, kind of like how the Japanese are leaning into a rice-based, koji-based whiskey, and no one bats an eye, you know? So I think that's kind of, yeah.
What does koji-based mean?
So they defined it as koji whiskey. So it's basically all rice, and it's fermented using koji. Koji is the national fungus of Japan. And koji, in its scientific name, is Aspergillus oryzae. It's a fungus that is responsible for soy sauce, for miso, for mirin, for shoyu. So all those Japanese condiments, sake, shochu, all those Japanese beverages are all because of koji. And so what's interesting is, so koji exists also in Vietnam, but the way that our ancestors and how historically Vietnamese, we produce our products, say whether it's like tung bun, or say whether it's like mam, or we have zambaung, or we have me, or we have all these other things like gum ziop me, or gum ziop nip, or you have, you know, ziop de, ziop chang. All those things in Vietnam are based off of a very similar but different process using bang man. And so that we take inspiration from the Japanese in terms of, like, you know, how they've kind of leaned into their heritage of koji and rice, and say we have to do something that's also very uniquely Vietnamese. So we chose sticky rice as the base of our single grain, and then the fermentation is driven by bang man. It's not driven by koji. It's not driven by Western malting styles. So essentially, what we're trying to answer, similar to what the Japanese are doing, or similar to even what the Scots or with the Americans, is if the Vietnamese 100 years ago started making whiskey, what would it look like? You know, what would a truly Vietnamese whiskey look like? And I think it should reflect our terroir. One of the things that distinguishes Vietnam from Japan is that our fermentation is based off of nip, whereas, say, in Korea and Japan, sake or even magoli, they're actually leaning into gauten as their main type of rice fermentation. Whereas Vietnam specifically, because we are so known or so ingrained with our nip culture, our, you know, gaut nip, that is what our culture prioritizes and values in terms of fermentation. We don't go for the gauten. And so that's kind of like what I wanted to reflect in the whiskey was, from the rice, how the rice is treated, how it's grown, has to be something reflective of Vietnam. You know, we're not growing rice in a Japanese style. Our rice is like, for example, our rice is nip gum, and it's also nip gum nuong. And nip gum nuong is so important to me because if you read about the history of Vietnam, the concept of nuong zai is so political. From all the way back to Chinese domination of Vietnam through the French, you know, all of that, there's such a politicization of nuong zai, you know, all the way back from like the Tang Dynasty, even like through the era of like Bajiu and Hai Bajung, for example, the Chinese were not able to conquer the people who fled to the highlands. They were able to levy their system of governance and taxation and things like that on the deltaic communities. But they had a singular phrase that lumped all people, including Vietnamese, Hmong, Thai, and all that, into one phrase. It was Lao. And so the Vietnamese would escape into the highlands to escape taxation and to launch a lot of the rebellion against the Chinese from the mountainsides. I mean, you have Mai Hak Day, which is a famous figure. His army was raised from the mountains to go fight against the Chinese, you know, rebel against the Chinese, for example. And then you fast forward to like even French colonialism. Like you can, there's more documented history where the French were trying to control the mountainsides, for example, and that was the basis of our resistance. And they couldn't enact taxation, but then also couldn't enact corvée French forced labor on people in the mountainsides because we were so hard to control up there. And that style of cultivation was called nuong zai, essentially. Zay is a borrowed word from the Thai Hmong language. Nuông is more Vietnamese, but it talks about hillside farming and Sweden agriculture. And that's something that's how we grow the rice for our whiskey. You know, it's something that has been for centuries. Our domination, like the people who've been trying to dominate Vietnam have been trying to squash this culture. But it's something, if you go to Vietnam and you talk to people, people will select out like, oh, is this rice grown? Is it Nip Nung or is it Nip Zuo? You know, is it Gao Nung Gao Zuo? You know, like our nuanced understanding of how rice is grown and how it impacts flavor is so nuanced. You know what I mean? It's like asking an Italian to go pick out pasta. There's so many types of pasta. And in Vietnam, it's the same way. Sometimes as diaspora, we are forced to remove from that, you know? So
as you are explaining all this to me, my brain, as fucked up as it is about stratification, I'm thinking about Koji as something that's, you know, like something that's very high attainable. And because of social conditioning, and I'm well aware of that, I'm thinking of like, is that process that the Japanese chose to do at a more, you know, is it, yeah, I hate to have these scales that go vertically, but in my brain, I'm like, okay, they're winning awards. They're like master craftsmen. Everything they pick and choose is, it has a lot of intention. And the way that you're approaching it also has a lot of intention, and it is really thought out. And when I think about all of the Koji and the man, these are all yeast, right? Is it fermentation agents?
Yeah, they're fermentation agents. So they're basically microbes, but Koji is a fungi. So Bang Man, the reason why it's different from Koji is it's a combination of fungi, bacteria, and yeast into one. I would say like it's interesting because the way I look at how the Japanese have done their branding, it's masterful. You know, they've turned fungus, which is something that's kind of freaky to look at, and turn it into something so mystical that places like Noma, all these Western chefs are like fawning over in terms of like this new fermentation renaissance. You know, you've got white guys in Brooklyn now making making sake from Koji. You know, you've got random bakeries and delicatessens in the Midwest, in America, aging salami with Koji. That's how amazing the Japanese have done. It's insane, right? We have, you know, there's a global conference now called KojiCon. I mean, we presented at KojiCon one year, but that's how good the branding around Koji is. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah.
See, and that's the question I was asking when I'm thinking of, when I'm hearing this and I'm thinking about the degree of a difficulty, perhaps. I don't know. What is it? I'm trying to figure out what is it that makes Koji so valuable? And it sounds a lot like the idea of time put into storytelling and marketing and like just building the equity of the Koji sort of mystique, right? And here you are, you're like, okay, I'm going to go with, this is what it all reminds me of. When you listen to artists, any artists, music or fine arts or sculptors or painters, I feel like they're talking about the reasons, the intentions, all of these things on why they're creating that piece. And the more you lay into that, the more you can explain it in a way that's clear and intentional and well thought out, the more money, the more value that piece becomes. And it sounds like the Japanese have done very well with Koji. I think whiskey from Scotland has done it's has a deserving place in the world of awards. And now you've thought a lot about men, and you've thought about the place that we are using this sort of fermentation. And how did you get to this? That's my first question. Like, why that? Because I'm sure there's so many different types of fermentation, but why did you choose that? Because I think that when I hear an easy way to do it would be to take the Koji route, bring it into Vietnam, but to rebuild a legend or a story or a modality of it's brand new. You got to really introduced this idea to the world and really spent a lot of time building that brand equity for that particular thing. And then, so we all begin to like taste the whiskey and we're like, all right, we can relate to why Daniel did this. You know, why that?
Yeah. Like, I think like for me, when you're making the analogy of like a music artist explaining like some, like the meaning or the drive behind a song, like I automatically get driven to like hip hop, you know, like I think that, you know, for me, I think that where hip hop has gone, there's so many elements of hip hop, you know, but then hip hop stands on the shoulders of so many things. Like there's a lot of remix that's built into hip hop, paying homage to whether it be jazz artists from before or whatever samples you can get, you know? So I'm not by any means trying to say that, you know, Bang Man's better than Koji or better Malting. What it is it's a little bit of like we're standing on their shoulders as well and taking a lot of inspiration and remixing it in a sense, in a way that's uniquely Vietnamese. I think that's what really makes hip hop also very unique, is it's become a global movement where countries can put their own spin or remix onto hip hop. So at the end of the day, we're still paying homage to, this is still whiskey. You know, we're playing by some of the rules of whiskey. We're aging it in oak that does not come from Vietnam. So that is our making sure that we're continuing the lineage of whiskey, just how people are continuing the lineage of hip hop. But our spin or our remix on it to make it very uniquely Vietnamese is the rice and the Bang Man, the fermentation. So the reason why we went down the Bang Man route was, if you travel across Vietnam, there in villages, there will be inevitably someone who is a fermentation specialist. You know, they are like a fermentation guru, fermentation shaman, or like, you know, of that nature, where their sole purpose is to continue passing down the Bang Man from generation to generation. And people in the village who are making their own moonshine, their own zeal, their own ferments are getting their Bang Man from this person. You know, I thought that was so cool because the more we collected the Bang Man, the more we saw one, there was variance in recipe. And then two, because of just the locality, there was also variance in the microbes. And so a ferment, say like you take tuong, right? You take tuong. Tuong bun, as opposed to another tuong in, say, the central region or the south. Or even if you take zeal. Zeal made from Nip, from the north, to the center, to the Mekong Delta. It may have the same basic inputs of rice, Bang Man, and distillation, for example, but it's going to taste different. It's going to reflect the terroir. And I think that is so poetic to me. And it's something that the variance is much greater than if we're just looking at Koji, you know, and even in Japan now, the people who are actually making Koji is less than like, I think it's around like five. It's actually a very, very small number. Whereas in Vietnam, there's so many people who are still trying to make Bang Man. And so why wouldn't we as a culture try and understand it? You know, there's a mysticism and a magic behind it. Yes. But there's also a lot of fear. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this was one was to understand something that drives so much of Vietnamese cuisine and food and beverage. But then also to help demystify some of the fear around it. And so we spent years collecting and studying how Bang Man was made from the north to the south, working with labs to isolate out what was in Bang Man and what makes Bang Man tick. So that we can clearly articulate to people, like when you're asking, why Bang Man instead of Koji? Well, I'll tell you why. Geum Jeol Nip would not be possible in Japan, 100%. Mm. And that's because the way that Bang Man works is a reflection of our terroir. What I mean by that is Koji grows at a very low temperature compared to Bang Man. It's about 25 to 30 degrees Celsius. And because of that, it produces different aromas and whatnot, and the fermentation is a little bit different, but it does not create Geum Jeol Nip. What I mean by that is, if you were to put Koji onto to Nip and you try to make Geum Jeol Nip, it wouldn't come out. If you put Bang Man into Nip and you do it, it comes out. You know, you get all the liquid, that really nice, you know, sticky, sweet rice, you know, wine, essentially. And that's the magic of it. You know, it reflects our culture's reflection of what nature gave us in terms of like ingredients. And Baimian is one of them. And so the question is, why? And then we found out is because in Baimian, there's more than just koji. There's so many other different types of microbes and fungi that can liquefy rice. And because Baimian can survive and ferments at a higher temperature based on Vietnam's climate, we're talking about 35 degrees Celsius where koji would die off. That's where we start to thrive, you know? So why replicate the Japanese? We should be leaning into our terroir. We're a hot and sticky climate. Our rice liquefies, you know, we have gumzio nip. We don't have sake. We don't have amazake, but we have our own thing and it's equally as good. And I think that's something that I would rather spend my life building a story and uplifting that than to try and copy Japan, you know?
I'm a huge fan of gumzio nip.
Yeah, it's good.
It's such a wonderful treat. And I think my mom was giving it to me even before I was 21, you know, legal age. And what it is gumzio nip is exactly what it sounds like. It's fermented into like alcohol, but you bite on the grains and it's like, I imagine like eating, it's such a weird visual, but like biting down an ant, you know, with the crispy, there's like a clack, 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 right?
It makes sense to me. I think of it differently. I think of it, you know, like when you have like Rice Krispies treats or like the Rice Krispies cereal and you leave it in the milk too long, that's how I think of it. But the ant thing does make sense. It's like really sweet ants, though. I don't know what kind of ants you grow. That was a huge
really sweet ant. I'm just, it's the pop for me. For me, it's the like whoever can do it with that, where there's like a genuine pop. And you know, it's like a perfect cookie, right? Like the perfect cookie is when it's crispy and it's chewy and it's just gooey, but then there's a crispy pop element to it. For me, that's like a perfect cookie. And gumzio nip, when it's done, like for me and my the way I like it is when you have the elements of crispy. I mean, obviously you're not going to get crispy in liquid, but as close to that as I can explain it, and the flavor that comes out of it. I did not know that it can only be made, you know, coming from Vietnam, because it's a very distinct taste that is beautiful. I think it's a national, it's a national dessert that's not talked about enough, because what other dessert in the world has this natural alcohol fermentation, you know, in the world? This natural, you know, alcohol that has, you know, just like it's a dessert and it's nice and light, but it's magical.
Yeah, and it's considered medicine. You know, women eat it after childbirth. You know, people will get sick in Vietnam because it's just like, it's all the nutrients in rice that's, it becomes liquefied in an easily digested form, you know? And I always, you know, if people were to try Japanese amazake side by side with gumzio nip, it's all made from rice, all made from fermentation, but it tastes completely different. It's a reflection of like where we come from, you know what I mean? And it's just, I think it's magical. And the, you know what's crazy? The pop and the crisp of gumzio nip is like, if you just leave it ferment just long enough where it starts to bubble and have like gas, that's where I think that, like, when you're saying crisp, I totally get what you mean. I totally get what you mean. There is crisp. You just got to leave it a little bit longer where it's just a little bit of a bite from the alcohol, you know, and a little bit of gas.
Wait, so that gas for me, there's sometimes a level of carbonation in it that makes me not comfortable. And because I'm like, is this by design or did you guys leave it on the shelf a little too long without thinking? Everything has to have intention, right? And for me, it has, you know, if you're not experiencing this carbonation all the time and it's just a hit or miss sometimes, you go to the same shop and sometimes there's carbonation, sometimes, most times there's not carbonation. Right. Yeah, so then I'm like thinking like, this is not by design, guys. This is like some accident or it's sitting on the shelf too long. Should it have carbonation, Daniel?
Oh, dude, that's the natural process. So it's weird because I first had gumzio nip in America too growing up. But when you move to Vietnam and a lot of the places like the wet markets are selling gumzio nip, they will actually have gum jeot nip at different stages of fermentation because it's for different, yeah, it's different uses.
For different clients.
Dude, it's different uses, man. It's like, you can get a buzz. I'm telling you, because I like younger kids nowadays who like to eat sweeter will get the one that's just fresh. Like it's like no carbonation. It's super sweet. But like older people, you know, like they like it spicier. They like it a little bit like with the fermentation, you know, like a little bit drier. But dude, once you get used to the fermentation and like how it's got a little bit of kick to it, it's like you can't go back for me.
Cause dude, it's like you can't go back to the sweet one, the new one.
Yeah.
I've always been the tongue of the old, because the old tongue, because I like it not sweet. I like it however you're describing. I didn't even know that there's levels to this shit. It's just mind blowing. I did not know at the wet markets there's like levels to it.
Yeah. When you come to Hanoi next, I'll take you out to a wet market, but we'll end with low ga gum jeot nip, because you'll see like the uses of gum jeot nip in different forms of fermentation. So for low, for example,
Let's clear this up with everybody. Low ga gum jeot nip. So this is low. This is hot pot made from gum jeot nip flavor.
It's made from gum jeot nip. It's not even the flavor. It is literally the broth is gum jeot nip. And so it's like this fermented rice. But imagine, right? Like if you did not let this ferment, you'd be like dipping your chicken into like sugar syrup. So you need to let it ferment. And you let it ferment and it develops this really rich, like umami rice flavor and just like being clean, you know? And what's funny is, you know,
when did they come up with this dish? When did they come up with this concept?
Oh, it's old school. It's old school.
Okay.
Because gum jeot nip has been around, it has been used in cooking in Vietnam because one, it tenderizes meat. Two, it adds a little flavor and acidity and umami. And three, it's also like, you know, it's alcohol. It extracts flavor from ingredients, you know? And it's also a good thing to drink while you're eating. So this low, this hot pot is served with nuk gop of gum jeot nip. So basically the gum jeot nip that's been aging. So it's more carbonated. It's more alcoholic. They strain out the rice and you're drinking these shots of it. You know what I mean? So
this episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
You think that, you know, like you go on living on this earth and you think at 50 or at 70, you've seen it all, right? You've eaten everything. And this is like in my mom's backyard. And I've never heard of it from her. I've never heard it from anybody. And you're like, this has been going on for eons, right? And I'm legit first time even hearing about it, and I'm so blown away. I love the fact that this exists, and I can't. I mean, it was one of the biggest things. I can't wait to go back to Hanoi to try. You know, it's such a beautiful. It sounds like such a tasty and delicious dish.
I mean, it's crazy because not many places still make it. And it's like, it's not uniquely the phenomena of forgetting and sometimes losing recipes is not a phenomena unique to Vietnam. You know, I think like all countries and all communities are so diverse. We have so many things going on in our lives, and not everyone in every culture is a foodie. And when we're talking about wartime and like era of like scarcity, food, you know, eating the best hot pot is not on everyone's mind. Like so many recipes would be lost. You know what I mean? And then like when you're a refugee coming to America, like you like sometimes like, I don't know, like my dad, for example, was in seminary school all his childhood. Like he was not in culinary school. He was not out there eating like all the different types of pho. So you only leave and come to America with what food memories you have. And when you're a teenager, that's not going to be the most broad thing, you know, like, you know, maybe my mom was studying at College of the Arts, for example. It's like she was not out there, like, you know, being a foodie. Like being a foodie was reserved for very specific types of people. And it wasn't something that was as big as it is today, you know. So I think like it's so fascinating to compare notes of like what people bring in terms of like their food memories to America, but then also like in Vietnam, what cuisines are on the fringes, you know, like what cuisines before, because of like, you know, because before like making, well, during wartime or war scarcity, there was a time where, you know, fermenting rice or using rice to make alcohol was forbidden because rice was scarce. Well, how can we let people turn rice into alcohol? You know, like we need to reserve rice to feed people. So over time, those things will get lost or will be like,
yeah, you can wipe out that whole dish because of that prohibition, exactly. Right?
Exactly. You know, and so, yeah.
There is a dish recently that I tasted. You know, I've been working with Chef Nguyen.
Yeah.
You know, just here an announcement. I've been working full time with him at Next Robot, you know, working in sales and spokesperson when we're out on shows. And, you know, that's it's great. It's a remote job. And I love the work, obviously, because it's food. And, you know, I've spent so many years, a decade and a half of my life in food. And the team that we work with, the owner, the management teams are, you know, from China. And they take us to these restaurants in the 626 San Gabriel Valley, unmarked restaurants. And, you know, unmarked as in there's no English. It's all in Chinese. And so you roll in and it's like packed restaurants and it's all Chinese people. And there's dishes that I've never had. I've never seen in my life, you know. And when you tell me about a dish like Lao Ga with Cơm Rượu Nếp, I think about this experience that I just recently had, eating a dish that was eggplant, bell pepper, and thousand year eggs with sesame oil and some chili. And it was like the most, it was a cold dish. And then they brought out like a mortar and pestle, and then they got it all like beat down. And it was the most magical dish that I've had it's like innovative. And this thing has probably been around for a long time, and this is the first time I'm eating it, and the first time I'm listening to you talk about Lao Ga, you know, Cơm Rượu Nếp. And it's just like there are so many millions of recipes out there that we don't know about, and it's just like the way that human beings create these things is there's all stories and intentions and cultural artifacts that it is being lost, I think, as time goes on. The McDonald's of the world and, you know, KFC takes over.
They call it nowhere maxing now. Like nowhere maxing is just like everywhere is just like the same as everywhere. So you feel like you're nowhere. Everywhere you go, like Tuscany is going to look the same as Saigon and Saigon's going to look the same as LA. It's nowhere maxing. It's really sad. You know what I mean? And it's like,
but do you think that trend is going to go away? Do you think nowhere maxing is, oh shit.
I don't think so, because the forces that propel us into nowhere maxing are just so, so powerful. It's like Star Wars, man. It's like nowhere maxing is like the Death Star, dude. We're like the rebellion with like freaking flimsy 2-3 X-Wing. Sorry, I'm getting into like nerd territory, but it's like Star Wars, you know, like David and Goliath, you know, like there's so much money behind nowhere maxing, you know.
But there's people like you, and you know, Min Pham doesn't want to be called a chef anymore. She's like, I'm an art, you know, it's like artist, you know. But there's people like you and her and Chef Nguyen Bui. You guys live for the not revival or resuscitation, but just to, I mean, I live this way too, is to bring out the cultural nuance maxing, right? For me, it's like cultural nuance maxing. I don't know how to live any other way. I don't want to, I definitely enjoy my chicken McNuggets, but at the same time, I live 99% of my time in the space of what is more that I don't know about the Vietnamese culture.
Oh, 100%. But that's like, you know, like I would say that we need this to keep going. Like we're definitely, you know, it's the story of David Goliath or like even Star Wars. Like we're not dying off. Like we're not going to be eliminated forever, but we're fighting such an uphill battle because every second that goes by is something else that's getting lost. I look at it like, look at ecological degradation, species extinction. We also think about knowledge extinction too, because like the more I study or try and research about Vietnam, I think it's just so daunting of a task. You know, like let's just take food, for example. The Romanized alphabet has only been proliferated in Vietnam for a little over like 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that's insane because what that does is it allows us to proliferate writing and literacy in Vietnam. And so like people like, you know, Thạch Lam, Vũ Bằng, Băng Sơn, you know, Lý Đạo Thúy, all these writers in Vietnam who are actually writing and documenting the culture, the food around them at the time, that's all such a small part of Vietnam's history because of the access to the Romanized alphabet. There was documentation that happened before. Yes, I'm not trying to disregard that, but that ability to write and read and write Chữ Nôm, for example, Chữ Hán, was so limited to the educated elites. You know what I mean? And so their perspective is only going to be a very small nuance of, you know, but to make it even more broad as time goes, because we're now in the period of history where this is the democratization of language, of being able to document your own experience. Like the insane ability of social media is like anyone, Kenneth, you know, Daniel, anyone can be the next Anthony Bourdain. You know, you don't need to have a deal from CNN. That's insane democracy. That's only in a very, very, very recent history in human history, you know? And so like what I think about that, what I mean by that is like when you read these books before social media, from the early 1900s, people who have been around since the late 1800s, they witnessed the birth of pho. Isn't that freaking insane? But you have to imagine at the time, because they are also human. Imagine us, right? In America, all of a sudden, matcha becomes like super famous. All matcha's the food matcha's viral. So everyone talks about matcha. These guys are probably the same. They're all like, you know, they're the foodies of their era. Like pho is popular. They're only talking about pho. Imagine all the other stuff that they're not talking about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they're talking about stuff that was in trend at the time. You know, pho was just coming into like popularity. You know, Southerners didn't even eat pho before 1954. Like people wrote about it who were alive during that time. They were saying literally in Saigon, there was 5 pho vendors before 1954.
There was no pho. It was probably all Hutu me.
Yes, it was all Hutu. And so like all these things are so fascinating to me because it's like we sometimes it's like it's so hard to not idolize or romanticize authors who are no longer around. But you have to remember, they're just like you and me. You know, when we get caught up in the matcha craze, when we're getting caught up in whatever looks maxing phase, they are also subject to the same kind of popularity. They were doing some other maxing, you know what I mean? They were Romanized alphabet maxing, you know what I mean? They were not Chino maxing anymore. You know, that was the trend at the time. Like, imagine all the slang that we're using now. Their slang was, we're going to use the alphabet, forget, fuck Chino, you know what I mean?
That's single grain whiskey max right now.
I know, dude.
I'm about to pour myself. This is awesome, Daniel. I don't know why we don't do this once a month. You know, I get to nerd out with you on so many of these ideas. You know, it's almost 7 right now. Well, no, 7:30, almost 8 o'clock. And I'm going to pour myself some whiskey here.
Yeah, yours is you're calling Chao Busang. I'm doing a nightcap. So you know what's funny? It's like Chao Busang, man.
Chao Busang. Cheers. Cheers.
I'll put myself in a small glass too to match yours. So so
oh, it's so smooth.
Thanks, man. This whiskey is like you're gonna get like a lot of savoriness at the end, like nutty notes, you know. There'll be definitely wood in there. I think like for me, like we'll get the tasting notes out of the way and we can get back to whatever like historical text maxing we were doing. This whiskey is Vietnam maxing, essentially. So what we do is, so we start off with nip gum. So nip gum, for everyone who's listening, is it's a purple sticky rice that was really renowned in the northwest of Vietnam, Tây Bắc. And it was a type of rice that back in the day was reserved and offered to kings because of its nutritional value and its taste. It tastes like tawny port. It tastes a little bit like raisins, a little bit like chocolate. It's an amazing, amazing rice. And one of the cool things about Vietnam is the north of Vietnam, northwest specifically in the south of China, is actually one of the hot spots of this mutation that creates what we call sticky grains. So when we talk about sticky rice, nip, when we talk about sticky corn, when we talk about sticky anything, anything in Vietnam with the word nip in it has this mutation and it creates a stickiness. What the Italians might call al dente, we call zale. You know, it's such an integral part of Vietnamese food vocabulary. Like the chewiness that the Italians are looking for in pasta, we look for in our starches. And we call that zale, and that's associated with nip. So when you go anywhere in Vietnam, there will often be like gay, which is millet. You'll have gay nip, you'll have gạo nip, you'll have bap nip. So bap is corn, gạo is rice, gay is millet. I've had, you know, sarn nip, which is cassava root, and it has a little bit.
Anytime you have the word nip, it indicates zale, and zale is. Yeah. What is the English word?
It's texture. So it's al dente.
Right. But you said it's there was a word you just used. It was the because I was like trying to translate zel into English, but yeah. You said it.
It's bounce and chew. You know, it's
chewy. Zel is chewy. Zel is like, chewy.
Exactly.
So I've had corn, so many different varieties of corn, but my mom loves this corn that's really chewy. And yes. That is now it makes sense now. That's nip.
Yeah. And you know what's crazy is that is a texture that Vietnam and Vietnamese people we're united by. Because even the hamon, dude, that is actually what I think about. Because if we don't all eat rice, so like say hamon and the nung, they eat cornmeal in the instead of rice, and they call it man, but they have corn that's sticky. They call it ngô nếp, you know? And if you talk to any Vietnamese person, we love that kind of chewiness. Kind of like how
you cannot have bánh chưng. I mean, is this in any other Asian cultures? I mean, mochi is kind of like that, right? Like when you think about
mochi is, but the thing I want to emphasize is the obsession with sticky rice and glutinous rice is in Japan, it's not on the same level as Vietnam. It's not on the same level because we have such a high regard for sticky rice. We reserve sticky rice. Dude, I don't know if you've ever grown rice before. Maybe you should come. You got to come for a growing season, man. You got to come for a growing season. You'll see how hard it is to grow sticky rice. It's much harder to grow sticky rice. And we use something that's hard to grow to make into these amazing, you know, bangs, all these cakes, all these desserts, alcoholic beverages. We reserve nip for the highest expressions of our cuisine. Wow. That's how much we revere nip. It's beautiful. And
but why? And Korea, if, huh? But no, why does... But why does nep give you a different flavor when it's in an alcohol form than rice?
It's the starch content. So there's two main types of starches. There's amylose. So amylose is like long, like strains of starch like this. They're like long strains. Amylopectin is like, they're like tied together like this. And there's, this is what gives sticky rice its texture. Rice with amylopectin that's high is glutinous or sticky rice. And you can actually tell when you look at a grain of rice. So when you buy and grab a bag of rice at the store, when the rice grains are translucent, they're high in amylose and low in amylopectin. They're not going to be sticky. But if you buy sticky rice and you ever look at it, it is not translucent, right? It's white. That is because it's high in amylopectin. And you know the whole thing of like light gout. When you cook sticky rice and you leave it out at room temperature, it becomes raw again. Do you notice that?
No. So in Vietnam,
we call it like gout or like gum.
And wait. So you dehydrate it and you let it get back to being dry. It goes back to its original. Can you reuse it again and cook it again?
You need to recook it.
But it definitely has to lose something, right?
Because you know, like regular rice, right? You can take rice that's been cold, like regular rice. I'm talking about gout there, and you can eat it cold. You know, I wouldn't recommend it, but you can eat it cold.
Yeah.
You could not do that with soy. You know what I mean? And so that's scientific phenomena only because of the amylopectin. So we do a lot of these trainings. I'm always like amylose, amylopectin, amylose, amylopectin. It's like it's such an easy way to remember. You know what I mean? It's like. That's what makes it so special, and that's what gives it that chew. But then when you're talking about alcohol, is because amylose is like this and amylopectin is like this, when the fungi or the yeast are breaking down the starch, this creates a lot of different flavor profiles than breaking down starch like this. It takes a little bit longer to break down, but you get a lot of different aromas that you wouldn't get from regular rice. For some reason, our ancestors said that smells and tastes way better than regular rice. Whereas in Korea and Japan, they're using regular rice gout there for their sake and their fermentation. But also because they didn't have as long of a culture cultivating sticky rice as we did. You know what I mean?
Daniel, you know, the last maybe 15 years of my life drinking whiskey, It's not that I'm embarrassed to say that Lagavulin, Lafroy, are my choice, my drinks of choice, but they are. I like that smoky, that peaty. But I never had a reason to, other than the fact that I liked it, because it was just like, it was just strong and it hit me in a way that, you know, is not subtle. But I think... from now on, when people ask me, like, what is the whiskey? What is my go-to whiskey? It's going to be Songhai because the connection to my palate on Zoot Nam, right? Gum Zoot Nam. It's bringing me this deep connection with, it really is bringing me to Vietnam. You there? Did I lose you?
No, you lost me for just a second. Sorry.
I was saying that now for me, this is bringing me to my entire life of Gum Zoot Nam, and it makes me understand the history of Vietnam's beauty in the nozel of. Our grains and putting it in this flavor, putting it in this bottle. Now I can say with confidence that this is definitely something that that is a new favorite. And I only get to have this one bottle, and I'm like sitting here trying to figure out. I'm going camping this weekend. I can alone by myself kill this bottle as I'm drinking with my friends. But where can we get this stuff now?
I mean, you can get in the U.S. now. We're sending another shipment. So we're pretty much almost sold out of our first shipment. In California, One of the retailers that we really love is High Times in Costa Mesa in Southern California, for people who are listening in your area. And they still have some in stock. We just found out yesterday. But we're sending another shipment in another month. So it's just been, it's crazy. We posted some Instagram videos and now we have a waiting list for this whiskey. It's, you know, what's crazy, Canada is like, I think spirits for us, like, we really did hope that making spirits was going to be like a platform to talk about Vietnam. And some of the questions that we've been getting from like non-Vietnamese people about how this whiskey is made is insane. It's insane in a good way. People are asking, because we talk about openly, what is Bang Man? They're like, what the heck is Bang Man? Like, can you go in further detail? Like, people are asking us, like, what is the effect of like dry farming in a Nuang system as opposed to flood? Like, I have this in a Word document because we're trying to answer it and make videos of all these topics that people are asking. And it's just like, people are so fascinated, like people who are buying this whiskey. And it's like really inspiring to me because, you know, sometimes, like, you and I grew up in a generation where Vietnamese food was not cool yet. You know what I mean? Yeah. I remember one of my friends, I brought Bánh In Sầu Riêng to my school lunch. And my friend was like, oh, I love Asian food. He took a bite of it and threw up in the fucking trash can, dude. And it just, like, you know what really sucks is it ruined Bánh In for me, dude. That was one of my favorite childhood snacks. And just watching my best friend just like this face he made, like, it just like destroys you as a kid. You know what I mean? But like now to see like people so curious about all the most like obscure things in Vietnamese like cuisine and even fermentation cultures, like, it just blows my mind, you know? I wish I was making it up. It's like, to me, it's like surreal, you know, to go from like in one lifetime where no one was like, not going to Sầu Riêng or like, you know, didn't know what Zhao Muang was, like water spinach. And now they're just like, oh, what is Bang Man? Or, oh, like, you know, like, I have Australians who are making these symbols of like, oh, now I know all the different like starches. And I'm like, dude, it's like, to me, it's like super humbling. And I think that's kind of like what we hope to achieve with making spirits like the single grain is like, you know, there's every single spirit should reflect the place where it comes from. And we think that Vietnam is super worthy to be on that national stage, you know, that global stage, you know? And so, yeah, people should be like, you know, I'm not going to say our whiskey is the best or anything like that, but it's more of like, we want this to be of Vietnam Maxim whiskey, you know, that's my goal.
This is ultimately going to be a bigger seller than gin, no? Because isn't there more people that drink whiskey than gin? I mean, by far? I mean, it's just a guess.
I think so. I mean, like, the way that it's taking off is I hope that one day it'll overtake the gin because, you know, to be honest, like, it has a huge impact on the communities that we're working with. Like, I think,
bigger than the gin.
I mean, I would say in a different way. So gin allows us to work with like people who are flower farmers, who are fruit farmers, whereas this whiskey allows us to work with like rice farmers, you know? And the volume of rice that we're moving through is insane. And this is not even like our single malt is like, it takes it even a step further where we're actually, you know, we're hiring farmers to make malt for us. But anyways, yeah, I think, this past month we've had to like triple the amount of like, farmers that we're working with to start to meet demand. And it's really good because I feel like this was the goal is like, hey, in the age of obsession of modernity in Vietnam, we want to show that there's so much value in the cultural traditions, in the beautiful past and history that we have. You know, like, I think you and I, we have something in common where we're romantics. Like, we are romantics for the slow, beautiful, like, thousand-year history that we have. Sometimes that is not convenient with the modernity of Vietnam, you know, where everyone's chasing these modern dreams. We need to somehow show that there is still space for the slow growing, you know, funky little purple rice, sticky rice on the hillside. Like, that's what I want. Like, I want like places of Vietnam to be like, you know what? Like, there's so much value in this, you know, and that we're so proud of this instead of like always chasing the commercial ring, you know?
I think that the way we look at it will never get old. I think that there is actually a new trend. No, it's not even new. It's probably millennia old tradition of when things are highly niche and you get in these little pockets of taste and you have to really be in the know of that bullshit of if you know, you know.
Yeah.
It's not even about wearing your Gucci, your Armani sweater and with the logos. This is on some other level, which is signifying our appreciation in a way that's not even, it's there's no loudness to it. You have to have a deep appreciation and ability to kind of like taste it, break it down, understand the history. And I don't think that that ever will get old. I don't think that ever will go away. In fact, there's a new term for it in the world of food and dining. I read it the other day, or I saw an Instagram clip, and it's called hushpitality. Hushpitality. Nice. Have you heard of this?
No, that's awesome.
Wild. This is fucking wild. Hushpitality is when you walk into a place and it's no longer about caviar and like the gold, right? The gold, whatever sprinkles. This is about knowing your gumzu nap. This is about knowing your single grain whiskey from some guy and not having to be loud about that knowledge. But the hospitality of it is whatever that restaurant is serving, that restaurant understands the story of where everything is brought in from. And so the patrons that are going there are at the highest levels. And it's like, it's no longer hospitality, but now it's hushpitality. It's like, we don't need to talk about it. And if you know, you know. This is like an exclusive club of people that can afford that. And it's like a new thing. It's like, but it's not a new thing. It's always been for the elite and for the people who are sort of like, who get it, who just understand and who nerd out on the details. And I'm not saying like I'm one of those guys, but I certainly think that your longevity in this world it's not going to die. It's never going to die because that idea of hospitality is going to be a thing as we move in to moving away from, you know, visual cues like Gucci and, you know, Adidas and, you know, that's for the masses, but this other stuff, it's not going to go away.
I hope not. Like, I think like the more that we're going into this, like nowhere maxing and modernity, it's so crazy. Right. But I think you're right. That's my hope. That's why I'm like still optimistic to fight this fight, because I feel like there are people who appreciate that. And I think that when people start to realize that this crazy modern rat race is just like degrading in a way, they always look for the slow and like the real mastery versus perceived mastery, especially when there's going to be so much AI slop, you know, going on. Like, people are trying to look for something real and raw, you know? And I think about that a lot in Vietnam too, because this past week, there's been like these investment conferences and, you know, there's going to be in the regions we're working with, they're proposing a new like golf course and like resorts and like, you know, villas being built and then taking over these hillsides. And so what they're saying is, you know, in the future, there will be less land to grow rice. And they're already capping expansion of rice growth, which is fine. That, you know, it's modernity and we can't fight that wave. But what that means is in the future, it's going to be much harder to find nip gum. It's going to be much harder to find, you know, gao zhou. It's going to be much harder to find these treasures of the past, you know. And it's like what you're going to say, you're saying is right. It's like, eventually it's going to be like, if you know, You know, when everyone else is eating the same rice grain, you know, like chasing the same rat race dream, there will be people who are just like, man, there is a beauty in taking time to chew and digest and really ruminate on your rice. You know, like that's the crazy thing about that living in Vietnam's taught me is that when people really taste their rice, it's insane. People like slow down to chew and taste every single morsel. You know what I mean? And it's so crazy. It's juxtaposed with like how crazy the speed of life in Vietnam is. And yet people can still take the time and be like, you know, when we choose rice and like rice of different harvests, you can really taste it when you chew. And that's like the juxtaposition I think we're talking about.
Beautiful. You know? Yeah. And I love the fact that I can slow down my day and have this conversation with you, you know? And meanwhile, the ironies of irony is I'm going into work with an automation, you know, we're on the brink of bringing automation into the kitchens everywhere in the United States at the moment. And it's exciting, but it's also like, we need it all. We need to be able to crank out food quicker because labor shortage here and labor pricing. And then the precision of a machine to cook is important, but also like, you know, to understand and slow down process and go for the taste and texture of these different things is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Technology has always been around, you know, and technology is inseparable from our human experience and our journey, you know, but it's like, we always, you know, what else is also inseparable from the human experience is the philosophical, the metaphysical, you know, like we're separated from machines because we have these philosophical dilemmas that we deal with. And one of those is like the contradiction of modernity and losing a part of ourselves, losing a part of our history. And how do we reconcile that? We can both be romantic about the past and the history and tradition and all these things that we can be romantic about and art and slowing down, but then also be tied to the fast pace. There's nothing wrong with that. I think like those contradictions and those dilemmas is what makes the human experience uniquely human, you know?
I think the next time we talk, which is hopefully soon, we can talk about literally what you just said. You lost me. Once you said metaphysical, I was philosophy and metaphysics. I'm like, we can make a massive departure from this idea of alcohol and product and really talk about metaphysical aspects of Vietnam and the culture and the philosophy and what draws you and binds you and I to this wonderful culture called the Vietnamese.
Yeah. And what really is like the Vietnamese dilemma and like, what drives us as like a philosophical culture? Yeah. We are so philosophical. Like you look at all of our poetry, all of our literature and our music, Vietnam and our artists are so philosophical. It's insane. You know? I wish we had even more time in the world to even break down like just the craziness of how deep some of like Vietnam's poetry and music is. It's like, yeah,
I want to hear from you because I don't know much about it. And I want to, you know, sit down with you in another episode in the next few weeks. And I want to get into it because I want to be introduced to that stuff and really, you know, absorb a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's something that we also need to make sure that somehow our diaspora, like we're still connected to that, you know, because it's so important to any culture to be able to have our own philosophical engagement with the world and our own spin on those things, you know?
Yeah. Daniel, thank you so much. Once again, this has been a treat. It's always a treat to be able to sit down and talk to you about these wonderful aspects of Vietnamese culture and living. Thanks again, man.
Yeah, no, thanks, Kenneth. It's a pleasure. It's mine. And yeah, I hope you have a good day at work and I hope to be talking to you soon, brother.
Thank you. Same here.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.